Now, we, all of us, each of us, at one time or another, is going to have sorrow and suffering. If your path has not been strewn with the limbs of adversity, blown by the winds of problems and sorrows, yet it will be. Your trouble is going to come. It may be that you've not had any nighttime yet. It's all been noonday, but nighttime is going to come. It may be that you've not had any clouds yet. It's all been sunshine, but your cloudy day is going to come. It may be that you've never had any defeats yet. All have been victories, but your defeats are going to come. The day is going to come when you're going to walk the hall of the hospital, and someone just on the other side of the wall where you're pacing is gasping for breath, and you're not going to know whether he's alive or going to be alive the next minute or not. And you're going to wring your hands, and you're going to, every time the door opens, the nurse walks, somebody walks out, you're going to say, how's he doing? Is any change in condition? Is he better? It's going to happen to you. You may not have known adversity yet, but the day is going to come when the doctor may say to you, it's cancer, the tests were positive, and it's cancer. And you're going to enter into that awful valley where so many have entered, and of apprehension and fear, and treatments and so forth, and x-rays and fears and apprehensions, and it's going to come to you. You may not yet have heard the boss say, we don't need you anymore here, and you don't have a regular job, and the bills come due, and they get stacked higher and higher and higher. It may not be that it's happened yet, but it's going to come your way one of these days. Maybe it has not been told you yet that your child has leukemia or some incurable disease. Maybe you don't know it yet, that you haven't been told you yet, but the day is going to come. It may be a serious illness that will be lurking in your body. It may be a serious illness in the body of someone you love like you love your own life. It may be the clash of steel on the highway, and the shedding of blood, and the sound of sirens as the ambulances come your way, and the cot and the oxygen, and a nurse and a doctor waiting for you at the hospital. It may be the emergency room doors will swing wide open, and you'll come through on the cot, and somebody will stand outside wondering how long you're going to live, and you'll wonder whether you're going to be alive tomorrow or not. It's going to come. Your time is going to come. Now, in a church like this, in a period of 19 years that we spent together, this is the story. Each person has come to his own time of sorrow. And when one person comes to that time of sorrow, the rest of us run to him and try to help him and try to encourage him. But until we mount to heaven, we shall never escape sorrow and sighing. The Bible says, sorrow and sighing shall flee away. But he'll not flee away yet. He'll not flee away until we awaken his likeness, until we're like him. Sorrow and sighing will not flee away. A stream of sorrow flows, and we cannot, no matter how hard we try, stem its tide, nor dam up its rushing waters. The road to heaven is not a smooth one. It is a rocky one. In the 19 years we've traveled together, many rough winds have blown, and many fallen limbs have strewn our pathways, and we've shed many, many tears together. One by one, we have wept as others of us have comforted us or cared. Tears have stained cheek after cheek as the rest of us have wiped those tears, waiting for the time when our tears will be stained, our cheeks will be stained with our own tears, and those who once wept would now console us while we weep. And one after another, like a mighty army, we've marched past caskets here at this altar. And you said goodbye to your loved one while the rest of us came. And somebody else said goodbye the next time, and you sat over here while the rest of the folks came by. It's been that way, and it'll continue to be that way. For one, it's been the death of a loved one. For another, the news that a child is retarded. You noticed, and we've had it happen again and again. You noticed maybe the child's eyes didn't focus just right, or he didn't smile at the right time. And maybe he didn't have control of his head like he should have. Or maybe his eyes looked a little different from other children. And you took him to the doctor to see what was wrong. And one day the doctor told you, and you took it with a broken heart, that your child would never be normal. And you went home and buried your head in your hands and put your hands in the pillow. And you had a heartbreak and a sorrow that nobody knows unless they face the same thing. It may be that you didn't feel well, had some pains in your stomach maybe, or you had some pains elsewhere, or you're running a low-grade fever. And you went to the doctor, and the doctor said, we'll have to take some tests. And they put you in the hospital. I was thinking today how Mr. Gifford went down to St. Margaret's Hospital. And I went down to see him, and he said, Pastor, he said, they haven't found out what's wrong yet. I went again the next day, and he said, they still don't know what's wrong yet. I went again the next day. He was so weak he could hardly stand up, but he still didn't know what was wrong yet. And some of us feared what was wrong, and he feared what was wrong. And I recall that day I went by to see him. I walked in, and he had found he had cancer, and I didn't know what to say or how to say it. I didn't have to say it first because he said it first. He said, come on in, preacher. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. Now, it's going to come. It may be that in your case, maybe a daughter was burned to death in the house. It may be that your home suddenly was taken by fire and a loved one was in it who went on to heaven in the fire. It may be that you had a child, went for test, and the doctor said there's something wrong with the blood. And they kept testing and kept testing, and finally the day came and the doctor came out the waiting room and said to you, there's no doubt about it, it's leukemia. And then there were hopes and added hopes and other hopes, and well, who knows what happened. And we'll not go into it a great deal, but tears and heartache and sorrow. It may be that the father went to heaven. It may be that your husband was killed in a car accident and you've lived a lonely life since then with a child or so. It may be that a son left home, broke your heart. You don't know where he is tonight. You long for a letter from him. If you'd just phone one time, if he'd just write you one letter and say, Dad and Mom, I love you. And I want to see you. If he'd just come to see you one time, put his arm around you and hug you like he used to. Those are just a few of the sorrows and heartaches. This week, Brother Fisk, I counted 13 straight people left my office weeping. 13 consecutive people, when they walked out of my office door, they bowed their head and began to weep. And two or three of them uncontrollably as they walked down the hall after having left my office. One lady cries so much when she comes in my office. She comes in and I make her cry. I don't know what it is. Maybe it's an ugly puss I've got. I'm not sure what it is. But I'll bet you a quarter. That's the crowd been grabbing those nursery ladies right there. Right? We have witnesses. But she comes in my office and she walks in, and even if she's not sad, she cries. And she's got where she comes in and she says, I'm coming from a regular sinus treatment. But that's the way it is in my office. And tears, I wonder how many rivers of tears have flown in my office in these 19 years. I wonder how many barrels and barrels of tears have dropped on the carpet of my study. I wonder how many tears these shoulders have caught in these years. I'm saying that trial is going to come. Now, this is necessary. We all have to face trial. Trial is as much a part of our lives and as necessary as the food we eat. Trial and suffering and sorrow is as needful for the developing of our lives and our characters as the water we drink. It is just as necessary as the sunshine we have and our homes that we have. It's as necessary as love from loved ones and friends. It's necessary. Now, the grapes must be trodden with loving feet before the juice flows from them and we can enjoy the fruit of the vine. And the olives must be pressed if oil is to come and give us light for our lamps. And the file must be used to sharpen the metal if the saw is going to do its job in the hands of the carpenter. And the gold to be refined must be placed in the burning coals if it's going to be the kind of gold that'll endure. I mean, we have to have it. There's no other way. We've got to have suffering. And true, 'tis true we all face suffering. Now the difference comes in how we face it. The surgeon's knife is going to come to all of us or someone very near to us. In the 19 years, I dare say there's not a person in this church, this room, who has not had someone in your family face the surgeon's knife. I dare say there's not a person in this room who in the last 19 years has had someone in your family that has gone on to heaven and you've gone out to the silent city of the dead and left your tears and left your heart out yonder in an open grave. And I'm saying it's going to come. Now, The question is, how do you take it when it comes? Some people, they take it like the psalmist did, Psalm 119:67. Before I was afflicted, I went astray. But now have I kept thy word. The same cancer is a stepping stone to some and a stumbling block to others. The same heart attack is a stepping stone to some and a stumbling block to others. The same death, that death is a stepping stone to some survivors and a stumbling block to some others. Before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now have I kept thy word. On the other hand, there are others who say, who said of King Ahaz, and the time of his distress, did he transgress more yet against the Lord, or transgress more yet against the Lord. Here's one Christian, one man, and trouble comes. And the Bible says that when he came, he kept the word of God. Now, the other fellow had the same thing, and he transgressed more against the Lord. I'm thinking about that family in Texas. I went out to see them one day, and the man and his wife were unsaved. I won't give you their names. The name is in my mind right now, but they were unsaved. They came to church one Sunday morning, my little country church, out 10 miles outside the edge of town. They sat here over here on this side, on my right. And both of them unsaved, very refined couple, and rather well-to-do, rather wealthy. And invitation time came. And I said, if you don't know that you're saved, would you raise your hand for prayer? He was on this side. He raised his right hand. She didn't know it. She was on this side. She raised her left hand. He didn't know it. And I said, you need to come to Christ. And I pleaded with them, but they didn't move. And they clutched the back of the seat, and tears streamed down both of their his cheeks and hers. And they didn't come. The next week, I went out to their home. A little circle on the north side of Garland, Texas. You're driving off a highway, little circle, and you drive back out onto the highway. Little circle of houses there. You've seen them. And I went in that little circle, and I went to their home. And I said, don't you want to be saved? And that they looked at me, and she said, I hate God. I hate God. And I said, why do you hate God? She said, he took my baby. He took my baby. I said, what do you mean? And she said, we had a beautiful little baby. It's the only child we had. We longed to have a baby. And she said, all of a sudden, it became ill and died. And she said, you think I'm going to serve a God like that? You think I'm going to accept a God like that? He took my baby. He took my baby. And I begged and pleaded, and I said, no, God's a loving God. In the first place, God never intended for any baby to die. It was Satan that brought sin, and sin that brought death. God never intended for sin to come. God never intended for death to come. It was by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin. So death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. And I said, if God allowed your baby to be taken, it was for some good. And I read the article. It was that couple that had sat right there. He and she had said, I want to kill you. I'm going to kill you. She said, God took my baby, and she said, it's your fault. And she pointed the gun at his head, and he got on his knees and begged her like that. And she shot him, slanting the bullet went in like this, and came out back here from upon his on his knees, and she killed him. And a few days later, she got in the car, driving 80 miles an hour. That's back yonder when cars wouldn't drive that fast and much, and got 80 miles an hour, and rushed down the highway, and slid off the side not far from our church. And ran into a tree. I conducted his funeral. In less than 2 weeks, I conducted her funeral. Why? God took my baby. God took my baby. On the other hand, there are people like in this church who had their babies taken. I recall Ron Perkey and Sarah had a little baby, and he died. They had another little baby, and he died. And the third baby, and he died. Have you noticed how that some people like Ron, Ron now is pastoring a fine church. He's in God's service full time. Ron said, I said, after I was afflicted, have I kept thy word? And others say, in the time of distress, did he transgress more yet against the Lord? I'm saying we've seen the John Finleys, and we've seen the David Giffords, and we've seen the Steve Huckins, and we've seen others who've lost their babies, and yet they said, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. Some make it sweeter. It was said of Spurgeon. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, who said, by the way, Spurgeon was very ill. When he was in his 50s, he was very ill. He died about 57 or 58. And he was very, very ill. And somebody said of Spurgeon, he speaks more sweetly than he did before he was laid aside. He speaks more sweetly than he did before he was laid aside. It was Rutherford who said, and I like this, he said, when God put me down in the cellar of affliction, I found it was there that God kept his wine, and I drank it and was revived. God keeps his greatest blessings sometimes in the cellar. God keeps his sweetest experiences sometimes in the cellar. Now, there's, on the other hand, some get bitter. Ahaz, King Ahaz, took the kingdom at the age of 20. He was an idolater. One time he was attacked with Assyrians, and he was warned by Isaiah. Isaiah said, trust in Jehovah and rely upon God. And King Ahaz didn't rely upon God. He refused and got more bitter and transgressed more. And Isaiah, into King Ahaz, wrote those words, spoke those words of Isaiah chapter 7 that spoke about the coming of Christ, and that the virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. And it was to Ahaz he said those words. But Ahaz got worse and worse and worse and worse and got bitter. And Ahaz let his affliction and let his distress cause him to get bitter, and he transgressed more against God. Now listen to me. More people, I guess, stumble because they get bitter because of adversity than most anything else. Here's a lady, and her husband divorces her. Maybe he runs off. Maybe he leaves her. Maybe he goes into drink. Maybe he goes off into deep sin, and he leaves his wife. Another lady's left. We have them here in the room tonight. Been left because of divorce, and they have little children, and the husband doesn't send a check, doesn't take care of his children. What a wicked, wicked kind of a thing that is, not to take care of your children. There's a man in this church, ran off and left his wife and two little babies many years ago now, and took off with somebody else and left his wife and babies, and didn't send his babies any money, and didn't send his wife any money. Nobody knew where he was, except I found out where he was. I was down there preaching one time where he was, and he walked up on the platform like he was an old friend, and he said, we'd like to take you out to have a bite to eat. And I said, I'm not going to eat at your table. I've seen your little boy I need at the altar. Pray and wonder where his daddy was too long. I said, I'll kneel beside you and see you get right with God, but I won't eat at your table. No, sir. No, sir. Don't you talk to me about anything but repentance. I've seen that little girl. I've seen her come down. I've seen her grow up. And by the way, I've invested several thousand dollars of my own money in those little kids. And I said, don't you talk to me about fellowship. I said, get right with God. You're wicked. You're wrong. You're bad. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. I've seen some little ladies who've been left that way. I've seen them get bitter and say, God has not been good to me. I've seen them go off, and I'm thinking right now of a young lady. A divorce came to her marriage, and she was left with a little baby, and she came to my office, and I tried to help her. I even gave her a job. I didn't have a job to give her, really, but I gave her a job and tried to keep her going for a while and invested and counseled with her and tried to help her. Then she decided that she wanted to date this person and that person. She's rather attractive, and she quit the job. She enrolled at Hiles Anderson College, and I was trying to help her so she could pay her tuition, so she could get a degree and make a good living. But she decided she wanted to go the other way, and so she went the other way. And now she gets peeved at the preacher and peeved at the church. Everybody's wrong but her. Whole world's turned around upside down, and hey, I don't need to go to church anymore. What happened? Adversity came, and she transgressed the more. On the other hand, I know of many fine ladies here tonight who've been heartbroken because divorce came. You didn't want it, and you didn't plan it, and you didn't seek it, and you weren't happy about it, but divorce came, and yet you've come to the Hiles and taken advice and counsel. You're trying to rear those children right. I know. I was reared by a mother whose home was broken. I was reared by just a mother. I can identify with every one of you little boys and girls that don't have a daddy at home. I know how it feels. I know, and I've seen my mother stay faithful and not get bitter about it. But now what happens? The same thing, the same adversity. Here's divorce over here. Here's one lady that says, I'm not treated right, and I'm going to have a good time, and I'm going to have my fling, and I'm going to live it over again, and I'm going to be a teenage girl again. Ah, how foolish you are. On the other hand, there's some who keep on keeping on and give their lives to their children and to their God, and they keep serving God and doing the best they can. Here are two college couples. The same thing happens. I've said it so often. It's happening right now all over America, and it's happened recently to some of you folks in this room tonight. When you first got married, a husband had to work hard at a laboring job, maybe a few dollars. You got a little apartment. Maybe you got some hand-me-down furniture or old furniture from a used furniture place, maybe. You moved it in, had to wash it, a washateria. And you didn't have a refrigerator, maybe, when you first started out, and you had to have maybe ice in a number two tub or something. And you had a tough time. You didn't have nice clothes to wear, and you didn't have a decent car to drive, and you had to push the old thing off many times. And then you worked hard. And one day your husband got a raise, and he came home and said, "I got a raise. I think we can afford now to buy us a little cottage." Oh, you'd worked so hard and so long and hoped and dreamed. And you remember, you went out and you began to look, and you looked and you looked, and those shiny new houses. And you said, "One of them's going to be mine." You'd save for several years for the down payment. And finally, you found the one. And that one had your name on it. It was your house. Nobody else could have that house. That was yours. And recall how you said, "Now, I'll put the sofa here, and I'll put the chair here. And what kind of drapes would go good now?" And you got some curtains and put the curtains up. And they were very, very nice curtains, the nicest one that Sears Roebuck had. And you got them, and you put them up, and you got maybe a little rug and put it on the floor. Remember when you got that first new living room suit? And you looked at it, and you thought it was the prettiest thing you ever saw. Most young people, it's allowed that God in heaven, the glare be rough on him. And you got your living room suit and the bedroom suit, and finally one day your husband came home and said, "I think we can buy us a car." And you went down and got you a shiny new car. Anytime somebody put his fingerprints on it, you got your, and you whacked off that little spot. You didn't know the car had been outside in the snow 3 months while they had it down to the place, you know, trying to sell it. And then you didn't know, they probably sold it to somebody else. They drove it a month. I had a wreck with it, and that paint on the outside you thought was new, if you just scratch it a little bit, you'll find another color underneath that. But just a word, you heard about the used car dealer named Strange, didn't you? They died, and they put, "Here lies an honest used car dealer, Strange." And it was. And you got that new car. Remember how you drove by and you honked the horn, and Mom and Dad came out, and you said, "Hey, let's take a drive in the new car." And the children were so happy and pleased, and they looked at the cigarette ashtray there and the cigarette lighter, and you said, "We won't be using that now." And you drove around and showed all your friends. And the car, it was only about, maybe 30 feet long, but it seemed like you was 120 feet long. Prettiest thing you ever saw. It was made for you. They are up yonder in Detroit. They had you in mind. And now you've got your furniture, and you got your car. And one night at church, you were so happy. Your husband taught a Sunday school class and had a bus route, and you had a little girl's class, too. And you went soul winning, the ladies' soul winning group on Friday, and you were so happy. And then one day, at church, the preacher preached, and your husband walked down the aisle. Well, that wasn't unusual. He did it often, walked down the aisle, and you knew he needed it often also, and you were pleased about it. And you said, "Maybe he's given up meeting his wife." And he knelt at the altar. And you didn't think anything unusual. But how stunned you were when the pastor stood up and said, "Ladies and gentlemen, our young brother here, one of our fine men, is surrendering his life to preach the gospel." And you said to yourself, "That's wonderful. He'll preach in rescue missions around town and supply in pulpits around town and keep his job, and we can still have the same thing." I see a lot of folks grinning right now because you've been right down through that. And then that night, you went home, and you didn't know exactly how to act. And you said to your husband, "Well, I'm proud of you." You didn't mean you're proud of him. You were waiting to see what he was going to say. And he said, we're going to be leaving." And you said, "For where?" And he said, "Hammond, Indiana. We're going to go to Hiles Anderson College." For everybody has any sense goes to Hiles Anderson College. And those that don't have any sense ought to go to Hiles Anderson College, because that's where you get some sense. And but anyway, you said, "But sweetheart, you mean we just got the house. We've worked for 10 years to get the house. And look, you're too old to start preaching. Look, best thing you'd do is support other preachers. And you've got a good job. And you're too old for that. And we got a new car. And we wouldn't have a job there. And besides, that's not the most scenic spot in America up there. I've been through that place before. And, honey, no, let's don't do it." And he said, "Well, sweetheart," he said, "God's called me. And I've got to be a preacher. And I'm not going to be a jackleg preacher, a second-rate preacher. I'm going to be a God's man. I'm going to prepare to serve God." And you went to bed that night. And you went to the living room. And you looked at that living room suit. And you said, oh, living room suit, I got to give you up. And you saw that new built-in cabinet in the kitchen and the pretty refrigerator you'd longed for. And went out to the window, looked out, and saw that shiny car sitting out there. And then you realized you had to give it up. Remember the day when you put the for sale sign out in the yard? And they came by it. I looked at the house, and you said to yourself, that's not right. This house is mine. It's my house. It, God gave it to me, and they made it for me. It's not right. And they came in, and the people, you couldn't even be nice to them. They came to look at you. Okay, look at it. how much did it cost? you couldn't even be nice. And you remember? And then finally, the deal was consummated. Consummated is a word. It means it was all finished. And it was consummated, and then you recall the day when you got that little rented trailer, and you put a few belongings on it, or little truck you borrowed, and you headed out toward Hiles Anderson College. And it was midnight when you got here. It's always midnight when everybody gets to a college town. It was midnight when you got here, and so you'd already made a reservation in a hotel downtown. You're thinking the downtown hotels would be elite, but nothing personal against these hotels downtown. They have the nicest mice of any hotels in the world. but it was dark, and then you tried to find a place to live. And you checked the classified to find an apartment, because where you live, the little town you lived in, the nicest apartment in town cost $175. And so you found an apartment for rent, and you went and looked at it, and you thought, now, this is not bad at all. And how much is it? And they said $325, 2 months payment down. And then your husband looked at you, and he said, you folks listening by tape, you should have been here to get the rest of it. All across the country, people said, look, when they laughed real, real loud on January the 13th, what did you say about 30 minutes into the sermon? And then you got the newspaper again, and you found another one, and another one. And finally, you found one that you could afford, $175 a month. It was up in the top floor of a two-story attic. It was already rented out to rats. And you were so mad at your husband, you thought he was adding to the rat population in the attic. And then there you were, up there in that apartment. And you got a little furniture, maybe. And you had a picture of the house you'd left. And a picture of the car you'd sold. And then your husband said, I'll be going to school at 7 o'clock every morning, leaving at 6:30. And I get out of school at 1, and I'll be going to work at 2. I'll come by and kiss the baby and spank the wife on the way. Going to work at 2. And then I'll work from 2 o'clock in the afternoon until about 11 o'clock at night. And then I'll be home probably by 12 o'clock. And then I've got to study for a while then. And then I'll have 3 hours to sleep. And then I got to get up and go to school again. And you said, but when are you going? What time are you going to spend with me? And he said, during the millennium, I'll be able to see you some. Now, we laugh about it, but it's not easy. It's not easy. And it's tough on the man, but I think it's tougher on the wife. And you sat there in an apartment that you didn't want to move into, with memories of your house. Now, wait a minute. Same adversity. What happened? I'm thinking of one lady right now. She said to her husband, I didn't marry a preacher. I didn't bargain for this. I didn't marry a preacher. You didn't tell me you were going to preach, and I wouldn't have married you if you'd been a preacher. And in the time of distress, did she transgress more against the Lord? And she left him. And he's here now. And by the way, she left him and took his babies with her. Now, let me tell you this, young lady, I sympathize with you, but when you did what you did then, I ceased to sympathize with you. I know you've got suffering. I ain't had adversity. But thank God for that great army of women in this room tonight who've given up and sacrificed, and you're lonely and you're homesick, but you say, I want us beyond everything in the world to do God's will for our lives, and God brought us here, and my husband's going to be a preacher, and I'm proud of him, and if he has to work day and night, and I can't see him like I ought to want to see him, I'm proud he's a man, and I'm going to stand beside him, and I'm going to help make him the next Charles Haddon Spurgeon. That's the kind of people God blesses, and that's the kind of people God rewards in the end. I mean, same thing happened to the gal that caused trouble and the gal that stuffed it out. But about one it could be said, in the time of distress did she transgress yet more against the Lord. And the other, before I was afflicted, I went astray, but now have I kept thy word. Here are two couples. And one couple has a little baby that's born, and so does the other. And both couples hear the words that the baby is very ill. And both couples hear the word that the baby can't live. And they walk in and pick the baby up and look at it and realize that the baby's little breath that they now feel on their necks will not be felt very long. And the little I love you mommy will not be heard very long. And those bright little eyes that look at mommy so lovingly will not be opened very long. And those little hands that pat mommy and daddy on the cheek will not be moving very long. And those little feet that pitter-patter across the house will not be pitter-pattering very long. They know the days are numbered. They know it's going to happen. And finally one night they walk in and hear the last cry of that little baby. It happens to one, and that one stands up and says, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. They stand faithful and become a testimony, an encouragement and blessing to all of us who know them and see them. And the other person says, God's not good to me. I'll not serve a God like that. And what happens is this, their life is wasted. Oh, let me tell you something, ladies and gentlemen. God in heaven never made one mistake in his life. God knows what's best for you. You trust him. And you say, though he slay me, yet will I trust him, for I know that my Redeemer liveth, and he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth. You trust him, and you say with the psalmist, after I was afflicted, I have kept thy word. There are two young men who come to college, and those two young men are the husbands of those little wives I mentioned a while ago, and they don't want to leave home early in the morning. They get up in the morning and kiss their wives goodbye. And that's not the time they'd rather kiss their wives goodbye, because you've seen wives early in the morning. That chill down number 5 has changed to perspiration number 6. And they need scope. I mean, not gargle it, drink it. And they kiss you goodbye and say, I can't believe it's the same one. They go off for college. And then when they get to college, they want to go spend some time with you, but they can't. And they rush to work. And they remember that when the 5 o'clock comes, they used to could go home. And they remember the warm meal they had. And they remembered the babies they could play with for 2 or 3 hours. And they remembered how that they used to put the babies to bed, and how they used to, they said Piggy went to market. They said Piggy stayed home. They said Piggy had roast beef. They said Piggy had none. This pig cried, wee, 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 all the way home. Or the one that my mother used on me. This said Piggy said, I want some corn. This said Piggy said, we're going to get it out. This said Piggy said, out of Master's barn. This said Piggy said, I won't tell. This said Piggy said, wee, 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 wee. And isn't that amazing? It's not everywhere that you get the literature that you get here. And they remember, and they're working out at UPS maybe, or over here at the steel mill. And it's 5 o'clock. It's time they used to go home. Little wives, don't you think for a single minute that you're the only one suffering then? And they're tired. They've worked, been to school, and they've sat in Mr. Minton's class, and oh, it's the hardest class in a school to stay awake in. And then he's given them 700 pages of outside reading to do before tomorrow morning. And then it's time to come home. And they come home, and you're right where you were when he left you. Same spot. Your hair is, no difference in your hair, is it's freshly rolled up now instead of been slept on for a while. And finally the bills stack up. And you come to Brother Howes' office. Every student that comes to counsel with me, just about, they bring the same list. Their income and their outgo. Did you ever try to bury Goliath in a matchbox? Me trying to figure out how in the world they can pay all those bills and on a $300 a month salary. I look at that thing and they'll say, I need your help. 15 minutes. I've got 15 minutes. And they say, I need you to solve my financial problems. And friendly Bob Adams looks more friendly than he ever has looked. Now here are two young men like that. And one young man says, I'm going home. One young man says, I've had enough. I can take it myself, but I can't see my wife unhappy, and I can't see my children not having enough time with their daddy, and I can't see us not having to get along. Listen, let me tell you something. Your children, your wife are 10,000 times better hungry in the will of God than full outside the will of God for their lives. One young man says, I have adversity. I have troubles. I'll go home. I'll quit. I'll wash out. The young man says, not me. Not me. God let me here. And I'm going to trust him. And I'm going to work hard. I want to tell you something, young lady. Those of you that don't complain, those of you that when you do see your husband, you tell him how much you love him and thank God for him and tell him how proud of him you are and you ought to be. Those of you, there's a special reward God has for you. Who knows? God may let that fella pass off the scene. You may get to marry a good man one of these days. But God's got some special blessings for you. On the other hand, there are those that wash out. I'll go home. I'll quit. What happened? Same adversity, same suffering, same trials. It depends on how you take it. Here's a man in full-time service for God. He pastors a church, and he has some problems. And he says, I'll quit. I'm not going to go through this. I'm going to go somewhere else. I believe God's calling me somewhere else. Here's this another man who says, I know it. I've got problems, and I've got fights to fight, and battles facing me. But God called me here, and I'm going to stay here till God leads me away from here. That's a fellow gets the job done. Same adversity, same problems. I'll tell you something tonight, folks. Let me tell you, preacher boy, something. Dr. Lee Robertson had the same problems in his church as you've had in yours. You just don't hear him talk much about it. I face the same problems, and in some ways I face the same problems right now that you face in your churches. I just don't talk much about it. The only difference in you and me is that you have me to come to, and if you let me say it, I don't go to anybody but God. I'm simply saying, the men of God that God has used in a mighty way are just like you. But when they face the problems you're facing that made you quit, they didn't quit. I've known them. I've known Dr. Bob Gray. When the deacons in his church, some of the deacons in his church tried to get rid of him. I remember when Dr. Lee Robertson resigned the Highland Park Baptist Church one time, wrote his resignation out and read it. I remember that. I remember. I remember one time when Dr. Tom Malone faced a battle in his church that most anybody would have quit over. I remember. Time and time again, the early days I was here, I wanted to quit, throw in the towel. Two preachers. By the way, here's the, and I don't consider myself a giant, and I'm not including myself in this, but here's the giant. Here's the great man of God. Here he is away. Here's the Spurgeon. Here's the Moody. Here's the Paul Rader. Here's the Lee Robertson. Here's the Bob Gray. Here's the John Rawlings and Bill Dowell. Here they are, over here. And on this side, You got a bunch of little preachers that have stayed, been moved every 2 or 3 years. Changed churches every 2 or 3 years. What's the difference? Preaching? No. What's the difference? The difference is they take adversity a different way. Here's a couple. Have a little baby. And they speak to the little baby, but doesn't turn his head where they are. And they get over on the other side and speak and say, "Hello there, Susie. Look at mommy." And Susie doesn't respond. And they get worried. And they take little Susie to the doctor, and the doctor tests little Susie's ears and says, "Susie's deaf." One couple says, "God's not been good to us." And they transgress more. The other couple says, "We'll teach little Betty Rice." You don't know this, but Kathy Rice, Mrs. Bill Rice, she went with Dr. Bill in his revivals. And she was a school teacher in a trailer that they pulled for their car. She was the school teacher for that little deaf girl. And by the way, in those days, they had no deaf curriculum. She wrote the curriculum herself. She made signs herself and invented signs herself. And she taught little Betty. And one couple says, "God's not good to us, we'll quit. I'm not going to serve a God that's my baby to death." But Dr. Bill and Kathy said, "We're going to build on this. And we'll build a ranch. And we'll let the whole world have a chance. All the deaf people all over America have a chance to have the gospel preached to them." Well, it depends on how you take it. It depends on how you take it. Here's a couple. Over here on Sunday morning, we have the retarded people. Yeah, I think we have some over here tonight, too, on this section. We have the retarded people in this section over here. First one sitting right here behind the organ, and it goes on back this way. But the retarded people. And I'll tell you a story about every one of these retarded children. I'll tell you a little story. Mother's told me so often what it was with her. When little Loreen got up to be, maybe a year, they noticed she was slow to walk and slow to say any words. And her eyes began to roll in her head. And Mother told me, now listen carefully. Mother told me how that when Loreen, they found out she was afflicted, she never walked or talked for 7 years. My mother's had 4 children. Hazel and I have been very normal. Lorraine and Erlene, well, but Lorraine and Mother Lorraine and Mother told me how that how she began to roll her eyes, and she never said "Mommy." You'll be 7. She never got outside the bed. She never took one step. Never said "Mommy." Never said "Daddy." Now there are 2 parents looking at that little baby. My mother and my father. My mother said, "I'm going to serve God." Though she never left her bedside, and my daddy got bitter. And that's where it started. The depression came. They lost their little grocery store. And mother said, "I've got a son and a daughter still I've got to rear. 2 of them are dead, but 2 are alive." I was one of the live ones. And make your own decision about Arlene, but I was one of the live ones. And mother said, "I've got 2 children I've got to rear." And my dad said, "I can't take it." Mother turned to Jesus and dad turned to liquor. Same suffering, same sorrow. It depends on how you take it. Here's a school teacher, Christian school teacher. I admire Christian school teachers as much as I admire any other group of people in the entire world. They go off to college, and they do without, and they suffer, and they sacrifice, and they starve, so someday they can get a degree, so they can go out and spend the rest of their lives sacrificing and doing without and starving. We pay all we can. Dr. Evans and Mrs. Stevens, our bookkeeper at the college, and Mr. Jorgensen and Mr. Mitchell and I, we spent good night, we spent, I guess, 7, 8 hours Friday night alone trying to do what we could to pay our college faculty a little more, and recommended the deacons a budget they could make a little more. And I don't know how many times I said that night, let's be careful now. Don't forget, anything we spend we don't need is going to take some salary away from our faculty members. I wish I could pay you what you're worth. But here's a Christian school teacher, does without. And God bless you. My heart goes out to you. And you don't know how I feel sometimes. I'm wishing I had enough money. I'd like to charge the people enough tuition to pay you what you're worth. But we have to charge the people more than they have to do that. And but here's one that says, well, I'm going to go out and get me another job. I can't teach. I've got to take care of my family. I can't teach and take care of my family. Here's another who says, I 10,000 times rather tough it and in influence the lives of little boys and girls for good and for God. Same suffering. One takes it and one doesn't take it. One says, I'll quit. The other says, I'll stay. The rain falleth on the just and on the unjust. King Ahaz. Ahaz was 20 years of age when he became the king. He was a wicked idolater. By the way, he was the father of Hezekiah, who became a marvelous king, one of the greatest kings that they ever had. But Ahaz, a wicked, idolatrous king. He had the privilege of hearing Isaiah preach, and the marvelous prophecies and preaching and warnings of Isaiah. But Ahaz had adversity. Because he did, he transgressed against God even more. But here's the psalmist. And the psalmist said, I was afflicted. But I served the Lord more after my affliction than I did before my affliction. Have you been tempted? Let your sorrows get the best of you. Brother Huckins says sometime, Mrs. Huckins, have you thought of that little baby boy who lay here in front of us one day? Mrs. Huckins, have you thought of the months you carried him and the dreams you had? Have you ever said to yourself, Mrs. Huckins, it's not fair. It's not right. Have you ever gone by the nursery up there and seen other little babies the same age of yours and said, why did you do it, God? Why did you do it? Huh? Have you? Let that leave your mind. Let that leave your mind. God knew what he was doing. Mrs. Salee, by the way, Fred Brewer, the guest we had this morning, if you saw him kissing Mrs. Salee this morning, I saw it. She sung her last solo here in this church. Let me tell you why he did it. She winked at him during the service. No. Fred was their pastor when they were young. He related this morning to my message when I spoke about young folks growing up. And he kissed her spontaneously because when she was a little thing, he used to kiss her. And when Jim and Mrs. Salee got married, he performed the ceremony. He could identify. And that's why, he forgive me for saying it, that wasn't a man kissing a lady this morning. I'm not saying, I mean, I don't go around, I haven't kissed any of you. you know, come think of it. You know, when they get around 17, they quit wanting to kiss me. They run down the hall when they're 5 and say, hey, preacher, let me hug you and give you a kiss. But when they get up 17, they quit. And that's probably for the better. But that was a pastor kissing a little girl this morning. Mrs. Lee, you ever thought about quitting God? You ever looked out in the audience and seen all these husbands and wives sitting together? You say, why was it mine? Jim Salee sat in my office one day. He had an offer for a job making $5,000 more than I could pay him. He looked at me and he said, I want to come here if you want me. After he died, his father told me that Jim Salee said he wanted to work for Dr. Jack Hyams. And Jim Flea told his dad, I'll clean the toilets if I have to, if that's all let me do. I'll clean the toilets to get to be there and work for Dr. Hyde. Miss Lee, do you ever put your babies to bed at night? One baby you were carrying in your own body when Jim was taken? Have you ever said in your hardest hours, it's not worth it. God's done me wrong. Why can't my husband be there when I put the babies to bed? Why have I got to carry all this responsibility alone? Huh? Have you? You ever doubt it? Don't doubt. Oh, let me tell you something. There's a God in heaven. There's a God in heaven. When I heard that my father was dead, after he had promised me just a few months before that he'd be saved, as far as I know, never was. First thing I did was get bitter. I put my hands in my head and said out loud, I said, it's not right. It's just not right. It's not fair. It's not right. You know I've been trying to serve you. You know I'm doing the best I can. And you know, suits I had on, I got in the college used clothing room. First sermon I ever preached as a preacher on a Sunday morning, I kept pulling my coat down in the bottom of the back because the cement had a patch on the seat of my trousers. And I said, it's not right. It's not right. Here I'm working for $21 a week, about to starve to death. And when my daddy died, I was making $20 a week at that time. And I went down to a place and bought a lawnmower. Jack Hiles, pastor of the Grange Hall Baptist Church, I went downtown in Marshall, Texas, with a lawnmower in the trunk of my car. Went up and down the streets knocking on doors asking folks if I could mow their yards. And I made a living mowing yards and preaching, pastoring a church. My picture would be in the paper on a Friday night, and it would be on the radio broadcast on a Saturday morning on the Old Time Religion broadcast on KMHT, Marshall, Texas. And that same week, I'd be out mowing yards. And I said, it's not fair. You know I'm trying to do what's right. And my own daddy died and went to hell as far as I know. It's not fair. Yeah, God's always fair. God's always fair. My father's grave was like a springboard for my ministry. Looking back on it now, I can see how it was best. Several times years ago, I told this illustration. I'll tell it tonight and close. Little two-room shack out the edge of town with a wood stove and sometimes not enough wood. One time I recall my daddy came home and said he found a cross tie. We cut that cross tie, one of the biggest days in our life. Talk about the energy crisis. And cut that cross tie up and had wood to burn. Little two-room shack with a wood stove in the one room. And sometimes a wood, sometimes a kerosene stove in the other room to cook on with the kerosene lamps and lanterns to give us light. And an outhouse out in the backyard. And drinking water from a well from peanut butter jars and grape jelly jars. And using for dishes lids from fruit jars for dishes. My mother would rock me to sleep. And often I'd be playing on the floor and I'd say, Mama, what are you doing? And my mother would say, Son, I'm embroidering. Got a little hook about this big. And she'd have some threads. And sitting on the floor, I'd look up and I'd say, Mama, it sure is messy from where I see it. And Mama would say, Son, you go about your business now. Mama knows what she's doing. But I'd say, Mama, there's a lot of black threads there, a lot of dark threads. I like the bright yellow, gold ones, but those dark ones are not very pretty. And it's all jumbled up. And my mother would say, Son, you're on the wrong side. You're looking up from the bottom. She said, now you go ahead and play, and one of these days I'm going to be through. And I'll bring you up where I am and show you something interesting. I'd go ahead and play. An hour or two would pass. And Mother'd say, son, come here. And I'd run up and get on Mother's knee and sit there and look at it now. And I'd look at it. I couldn't believe it. Maybe a sunset. Maybe a daisy. Maybe a tree. Maybe some other kind of a flower. And my mother, I'd say, Mother, how pretty. And Mother'd say, son, you're looking at it from the wrong side before. From my side. She said, son, what you didn't know is that somebody had drawn on the top of this material a pattern, and I was only following the pattern. She said, from my side, I knew what I was doing. I look up tonight and I said, dear God, what are you doing? And the Lord says, I'm embroidering a life. And I said, Lord, it's like a mess from where I am. Forgive me, I don't have any burdens. I don't have any heartaches. I don't have anything I ought to complain about. But you don't know how many times I've asked God, why have I got a cough all the time when I preach? You don't know how I pray every sermon I preach. Lord, help me tonight to not get clogged up in here. Lord, why did my daddy go to die without Christ? Why? Sure is a mess. Why? The Lord says, now, son, you go about your business. One of these days I'm going to bring you up here to heaven, let you sit on my knee, and I'm going to show you something you don't know now. And you mark my word, every lonely night that you've ever spent in a college apartment, God's going to tell you why one of these days. And you mark my word, if a night that you've worked and worked in some factory somewhere after going to school and trying to stay awake, and you've worked and worked and your little children, family's at home and you wish you were there, God's going to tell you why one of these days. There's a plan that God is weaving. From the underside, it looks mighty messy. But one of these days, bless God, you're going to find out there's a purpose behind it all. But the psalmist said, after I was afflicted, he said, I served God the more. Ahaz transgressed the more. Same affliction, same suffering, same heartache, same burden. Depends on how you take it.